Hello everyone, welcome to the 10th episode of the AJSP Editors Podcast. This is Kim Pong Tam, your host, and we have two more hosts here, Angela Leung and Sammy Gan. Now, we started this podcast in 2021 and time flies, and we're now in the third year. We have two objectives in this series. First of all, we want to introduce our publications to the global community. Second, we want to nurture the next generation of Asian social psychologists. In each episode, we have two sections. The first section is Editor's Pick. The second is special topic discussion. So without further delay, let's begin with our editor's pick. So this year, we're going to discuss a paper from the most recent issue, which is the June issue of our journal. It is a paper picked by Sammy. So Sammy, would kind of help us summarize the paper first.
Okay, thanks, Kevin. So the paper that I've chosen for this section has a focus on evaluating the tenets of system justification theory across culture and is entitled Testing the Status Legitimacy Hypothesis, Predicting System Justification Using Objective and Subjective Socioeconomic Status in China and the United States. So the paper is authored by Valdis, Liu, and Williams, all based at Massey University in New Zealand. System justification theories is arguably one of the more influential theories in social and political psychology, and in essence proposes that people are motivated to see the system within which they're embedded, such as political and economic systems, as legitimate, fair, and just. The motivation to justify system fulfills existential, epistemic, and relational motives. One important tenet of the theory, which has been supported by an extensive body of empirical research, is that the more one is dependent on a given system, the more likely one is to justify that system's legitimacy, fairness, and justness. Furthermore, both high and low status individuals within a given system may justify it, but for different reasons. So the status legitimacy hypothesis, coined by Mark Brand in 2013, predicts that people with lower status within a given system will, at least under some conditions, be more likely to view that system as more legitimate than people with higher status. So the logic behind the status legitimacy hypothesis is that people are motivated to see themselves, the group that they belong to, and their larger systems within which they're embedded in a positive light. Those with high status within a system rely on it for maintaining their high status position, or in other words, the status quo. There are no conflicts between their motivations. However, for individuals and groups with low status within a given system, the motivation to view oneself, one's group, in a positive light conflicts with the motivation to see the social system as positive, or any given system. To resolve this psychological conflict, people with low social status may, under some conditions, legitimize a system to a greater extent than those with high status within a given system. So this resolves any dissonance experienced in terms of the conflict between the positive value that individuals place on themselves and their groups with the systems within which they're situated. Findings with regard to the status legitimacy hypothesis have been mixed, and the premises of the status legitimacy hypothesis have been vigorously contested. One of the arguments for why findings regarding the association between status and system justification has been inconsistent is that the operationalization of status has been too simplistic in previous research. So it's been argued that status, such as socioeconomic status, must be thought of as having both an objective and subjective dimension. For example, you may have low objective socioeconomic status when comparing your income across the population, but you may still be better off than people in your own social networks. So even though one doesn't have high socioeconomic status in objective terms, one may see oneself as having high socioeconomic status in subjective terms. Likewise, one may be well off in objective terms, but still perceive oneself to be worse off compared to other comparison groups. Recent research examining the status legitimacy hypothesis in China has shown that objective socioeconomic status operationalizes education and income levels is negatively associated with system justification beliefs, whereas subjective social status is positively associated with system justification beliefs. However, this was only established with cross-sectional data and with university students. In the current study, the association between socioeconomic status, both objective and subjective, and system justification beliefs was examined longitudinally with representative samples and comparatively with samples from both the US and China. In terms of hypothesis, the authors formulated that subjective social status would be positively associated with system justification in both country samples. However, regarding objective socioeconomic status, they hypothesized that there would be a negative association with system justification in China and a positive association in the US. This is because the justification of the system may be a rational decision in China in lieu of cognitive alternatives as the country doesn't enjoy the same civil liberties as in the US. This means that people may not perceive themselves to be responsible for their own status within that system, as they have little input into how that system is modeled and functions. However, if living in a system that enjoys a high level of civil liberty, such as the US, it would be more reasonable for people to believe that upward mobility is a true possibility and thereby justify the system. As mentioned previously, the authors analyzed longitudinal samples from the US and China, with both being representative on age, gender, and regions. The data then was collected at two time points in both countries. System justification was measured using a brief system justification scale consisting of four items that has been used in previous research, and the measure was found to have high internal reliability in both countries. Objective social status was operationalized as education levels, ranging from elementary school to graduate school, as well as family household income before taxes, which then was transformed into percentile ranks to make it equivalent between countries. Subjective social status was measured with a single item measure, asking participants to position themselves on a scale ranging from 1 to 10, with 1 representing those that are the least well-off in society and 10 representing those that are the most well-off in society. Age and gender were controlled in all analysis, which consisted of both cross-sectional and longitudinal analysis. Before proceeding with the main analysis, though, measurement invariance was assessed, and the findings showed that system justification and objective and subjective status were metrically equivalent between the countries, allowing for equivalent comparisons. In terms of mean values, system justification was higher in China compared to the US, which is kind of consistent with the hypothesis. In the cross-sectional analysis with the wave one data, subjective social status was found to be positively associated with system justification beliefs in both China and the US. Regarding objective social status, it was found that income negatively predicted system justification, while education had a non-significant association with system justification. However, in the US, both education and income were non-significantly associated with system justification beliefs. Turning to the longitudinal analysis, subjective social status was positively associated with system justification beliefs in both countries. The overall effect of both education and income on system justification beliefs were still non-significant in the longitudinal analysis. But turning to the marginal effects, it was found that education but not income was positively associated with system justification beliefs over time in China, and that the opposite was found in the US sample. Income but not education was positively associated with system justification beliefs. So the main and most reliable finding from the analysis was that subjective and not objective social status was positively associated with system justification beliefs. This was found both cross-sectionally and longitudinally. So this is also consistent with a large body of evidence from previous research. But importantly, no support was found for the status legitimacy hypothesis using both subjective and objective indicators of socioeconomic status in both countries. This was contrary to hypothesis in previous research set in China. So those with low status did not legitimize the system to a greater extent than those with high status. The authors then argue that perhaps additional moderators need to be included in research to further examine the conditions under which low status groups may identify to a greater extent with the system. Based on previous research, they mentioned variables such as group identification, self-esteem, and perceived mobility. And another argument that they put forward for why they didn't observe the status legitimacy effect is because system justification beliefs may wax and wane. It may be high at one point in time and then low at another point in time. And there's actually a quite interesting discussion that they provide authors with that stimulates a lot of thinking with regard how to one could proceed with examining the status legitimacy effect further in the Chinese and also non-Chinese contexts. The main strength of this paper, in my opinion, is its focus on political psychology and cultural context. And this type of research always attracts me. So I was supervised by James Liu, and that could be the reason for why I enjoy this type of research. The main strength of the paper is that it focuses in on two distinct countries with distinct social, cultural, political, and economic systems. So in doing so, it offers contextually rich and motivated hypotheses as to why differences may be observed between the two countries. The paper is arguably quite heavy on theory, which I see as being a real strength. And of course, another strength of the paper and the research is that it is based on strong sampling with large representative longitudinal samples from two countries, which are then analyzed both cross-sectionally and longitudinally. So that's essentially my summary of the paper and the reasons for why I chose it and why I believe it to be strong. So I'm going to turn the microphone over to Kevin and Angela. So perhaps Angela, what did you think of this paper?
Yeah, thanks, Sammy, for picking this paper and giving us a very nice overview of the research findings. As Sammy has explained, there are a lot to like about this paper. I think one strength of the paper is that it's both theoretically and methodologically strong. I think in the field, there is an analogy that the theory is about the head and statistical methods is about the hand. I'm always very impressed by those papers that are strong and rigorous in both the head and the hand. And I think this paper is commendable that the research team has conducted the multi-group CFA to check measurement invariance of the key variables in the study. And I find it very important information because the research involves two country samples from China and the US. So it's good to supplement with this measurement invariance analysis to show that the measures can be applicable in both country samples. And it is, of course, a very nice feature of the research to have performed both cross-sectional and cross-necked analysis. And also theoretically, I think it has made a significant contribution to show that findings can diverge for subjective SES and objective SES. From my own reading of the SES literature, it is actually quite common that expected findings tend to emerge on the subjective SES variable rather than the objective SES variable. So the current findings are consistent with the existing literature in this regard. So this suggests that people's subjective evaluations or perceptions of their own socioeconomic standing in comparison to others in the society may be more key to affect their everyday social functioning. And it also speaks to the importance of measuring both subjective and objective SES in the research so as not to miss important nuances of these two dimensions of SES. So I'll pass the time to Kevin to let us know maybe other insights about the strengths of the paper. So Kevin?
Yeah, thanks, Sammy, for summarizing the paper. And also thanks to Angela and Sammy for telling us what's good in this paper. And I also agree that a lot of things to like in this paper. Theory-wise, it's very strong, very tight. Everything's explained very carefully and clearly. And methodologically, I can see a lot of effort by the authors, right? And attention by the authors to every single step in the design of the study and also the analysis. Of course, the use of a longitudinal design is a plus. When it comes to sampling, they carefully determined sample size, power analysis. They didn't choose to use the convenience sample. They tried to enhance the representativeness of the sample by using some quota sampling, generating sample data, resembles the distribution of certain important, demographic backgrounds to the population. They also spent some effort in terms of handling the missing data. They used the multiple imputation method, which is also a very advanced method nowadays to handle missing data. They also tested the measurement invariance. That's also something Angela mentioned. I think so you can see that every single step, they were very careful in terms of how they planned the study, in terms of how they analyzed data when it became available. That's the thing that really encourage our audience, particularly those who are early in their career or students, to make reference to, right? This is actually a very nice, very good example for how to conduct a study. Because we handle a lot of manuscripts, right? Now, some of manuscripts are not up to standard because the theory is not good. Sometimes these manuscripts, the research questions are really interesting. They explain the theories behind very well. But then when it comes to the method part, it's not very rigorous. That maybe it's just a student sample or self-report measures. And then they just jump directly into calculating the correlations or regressions. And that's it, right? And then obviously lots of issues that you have to handle before you can say that, okay, here is a very convincing evidence or answer to the research question. So think carefully about these little steps in terms of design, sampling, the use of the measures, and also how you analyze the data, how you clean the data, how you treat the missing data, etc. So all these little steps taken together could enhance the credibility of your findings. So would they give you a better chance of publishing the paper? But, and of course, more likely the paper will receive attention and make a more greater impact in the field. Another strength in this paper I really want to discuss is the reporting of the paper. Now, the theory is actually quite complicated, right? A lot of ideas there, kind of mixed results, how to reconcile with the different ideas, and you have to talk about different cultural contexts, etc. There are a lot of contents in the theories, but then, well, these things are explained very clearly. I didn't have a lot of difficulty following the arguments. The description of the method, very clear, nothing missing. All the information I want to know about the method is there already in the paper. There's also a section reporting descriptive analysis, which is important, right? Now, of course, you want the statistical test, you want to test your hypothesis. But before that, it's actually important for readers to understand more about the distribution of responses, for example. These are very basic things that actually you should report, right, in a paper. And they also have these very nice visualizations of some of the effects. So in terms of reporting, I think there's also a lot of things that readers and audience can learn from these paper. In general, I consider these paper a very nice example what a kind of a good research paper looks like, right? In terms of theory, in terms of method and analysis, also in terms of reporting. That's how I see it.
Thanks for those assessments of the paper, and I agree with them fully. It is a very nicely crafted paper and nicely crafted analysis. And with that, of course, all boxes are ticked in terms of the theory, the methods, and the presentation of it, and of course, the research in and of itself. Of course, it does stimulate some thoughts with regard to future research, and I've always thought of this with regard to system justification. So I think it's interesting in this paper that, and in other research as well, that the separation between objective and subjective social status, which doesn't just apply to political psychology, other fields of psychology as well, where it becomes relevant to distinguish between objective and subjective dimension with regard not only to socioeconomic status, but also other dimensions. But I'm also thinking about system justification here, whether or not it's necessary to consider multidimensional operationalizations of systems within and between countries. What is the system that we're talking about? So it could be that we are embedded in many different systems. And on average, when you're asking a general or universal questions, one is then indicating one's view of the legitimacy of all systems overall. But it could be equally feasible that you consider the political system to be fair and just, but perhaps not the economic system, or vice versa, depending on who you are. So perhaps some kind of multidimensional operationalization of system, because equally you may have high status in one system, but low status in another system. Also, I haven't actually seen any qualitative research on that that could try to at least understand people's lay beliefs. How do we conceptualize the systems that we're living in? Are we thinking of them as being one or one system within which there are many different systems? And how people think about that and their status within those conceptualizations of different systems. On the one hand, understanding how people conceptualize different systems. On the other hand, how they conceptualize their status within those systems, and whether or not that can be then captured psychometrically, and whether or not we can map out differences between them and the consequences that they have for a range of variables that we know are relevant for system justification, such as well-being, for example. And of course, the authors allude to this in the paper as well, the waxing and waning of system justification. So of course, that does require it's hard to conduct longitudinal research, but trying to understand that this waxing and waning, what happens over time? How does perceptions of the legitimacy of systems increase or decrease? What is the association between increases and decreases to social change? And the relationship is probably bidirectional, but trying to capture that process. How does societal change and system justification go hand in hand? And what type of events and what type of phenomena may shape that relationship? Kevin and Angela, perhaps we start with Kevin. Did you have any thoughts with regard to future research?
I'm personally very interested in this area of research. Like, I have to say that I'm not an expert in this specific area. But there are two things I'm thinking about. I'm curious to know kind of whether system justification is something that would kind of transmit across generations within the family. So to what extent the intergenerational transmission of system justification motives, and to what extent if this transmission happens, to what extent it can be attributed to the socioeconomic status of the family. So that's one thing I'm quite interested in knowing. Another thing is maybe more related to this specific paper. The paper examines the relationship, right, between status and system justification. And the system justification here was operationalized in terms of responses to a measure for item scale with items such as, in general, I find society to be fair, etc. So this kind of psychological scale of system justification. I'm just curious to what extent system justification will also manifest in terms of behaviors, because I know of studies that examine the relationship between socioeconomic status and action, such as political action or civic engagement, etc. So I'm just wondering to what extent we can connect these kind of studies about status and action and the topic in this specific paper about status and system justification, to what extent we can understand the relationship between status and political action, for example, through the mechanism of status legitimacy or system justification, etc. So I look forward to seeing more kind of evidence in terms of the, simply put, you can say behavioral implications of the psychological processes discussed in this specific paper. So that's two ideas I have when I was thinking about future directions. How about you, Angela?
I think one inspiration I got from this research is, like, after reading it, I kind of keep thinking about what is people's motivations, right, underlying the system justification tendency. I suppose people may have different motives to justify the system in which they are part of. So interestingly, people from different levels of SES may or may not share the same motive. And I think Sammy also mentioned at your beginning of the summary that there are a lot of inconsistent findings with regard to SES and system justification, and probably there would be a lot of moderating variables that would affect this relationship. Personally, I find it quite interesting to understand the link between system justification and perceived fairness of the system. For example, I think both high and low SES individuals may justify the status quo because they endorse the system as fair, and they see themselves as deserving of being placed at a high or low social standing. But also, it could be possible that these individuals do not see the system as fair, but still, they would choose to justify the system and justify the status quo. For instance, high SES people may justify the unfair system because it fulfills the self-enhancement motive. And of course, it can help protect high status and privilege they have been enjoying in the society. On the other hand, low SES people may justify the unfair system because they receive highly valued welfare benefits given the lower social standing. And maybe for them, upward social mobility may not be their priority or aspiration. So I suppose these psychological motives and also the perceived fairness of the system would be very interesting to further study in the future. And also related to the current research, these psychological motives may be more likely to be driven by people's subjective SES, because that is how they see themselves in the society in comparison to others. And it could explain why people's subjective SES would be more consistently predictive of the system justification tendencies. So these are some inspirations I got reading the paper, and hope our future research can address some of these questions.
Thanks, Angela, Sammy, for picking this paper and discussing the strengths and the directions for future directions. As usual, I strongly encourage our audience and our readers to read, of course, not only this paper, although this is obviously a paper that we three of us like a lot, but of course, there are many other papers that we publish in the June issue. So do pay some time reading those articles. So we'll come back with this special topic discussion in a minute. Okay, welcome back to the second part of our episode today, which is this special topic discussion. And the topic today is academic conferences. So why this topic? Obviously, attending academic conferences is an essential part of a researcher's life, right? I know some people even attend multiple conferences in a year, like summer, obviously very busy season for attending conferences. But what exactly do researchers do when they attend conferences for psychology specifically? What do we do in the psychology conferences? What do people do there? Of course, in the past several years, we've been experiencing the impacts of the pandemic, and the way we organize and also attend conferences have also kind of impacted as a result. So in the face of this pandemic or maybe other crises like climate change, have there been any changes in terms of how, you know, conferences are conducted? So we believe that this topic would be very useful for our audience, particularly those who are in the early part of their career and also student researchers. I think this discussion will help them understand better how they can make the most out of academic conferences for their own professional development. So we are very happy today to have Emma Buchtel to be our guest in this special topic discussion. She's currently associate professor and associate head in the Department of Psychology at the Education University of Hong Kong. We have been working with each other for some years because Emma has served as our associate editor for several years. And most important, she's now chairing the organizing committee for the upcoming AASP 2023 conference. It's going to be held in Hong Kong in the coming summer. And so no doubt she is the best person we can think of to talk about this topic, okay, about academic conferences. So hello, Emma. Thanks for coming.
Hey, Kevin. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot. So let me just start with the question. I always start the question with our guests. Just a question letting us know a little bit more about you. How did you fall in love with social psychology? So how did your journey with social psychology begin?
Okay, so actually when I saw this question, my first instinct is a feeling of guilt because, to be honest, I actually fell out of love with social psychology. So when I was an undergrad, I was a psychology major and I got kind of bored with all the facts that psychology seems to have had. So actually, when I was in an undergrad, I decided to do what I, at that point, we were allowed to do, which is actually replace some of the psychology courses with philosophy courses. Because I am not so interested in actual reality. I am actually really interested in what we think about reality and how what we think is reality affects how we behave and interact with people. So what we believe changes what reality actually is to us. So I think that for me, I love social psychology because it is about this very counterintuitive realization that you don't have as much control as you think over the way you behave, for example, that our social environment influences us maybe without our awareness or more than we think it would. So I guess that is the part of social psychology that I do still really enjoy, that we discover that our mind is working in ways that we were not so aware of. But by becoming more aware of that, for example, like how our prejudices and stereotypes that are sitting around in the back of our heads may actually influence the way we act towards people, even though we didn't want to act that way. That kind of thing is very interesting to me. And it's also what I really enjoy teaching about, for example, and researching.
I see. Thanks for sharing about this personal story. We have actually heard of a lot of stories from our different guests and different persons of different stories. That's really a part I like in this special topic discussion. So now let's get into the substance of our discussion today. I want to start with a question about the upcoming AASP conference, right? Asian Association of Social Psychology Conference, which is held every 2 years, right? And this year, 2023, we have it in Hong Kong in the coming summer. And as I mentioned earlier, Emma is now chairing the organizing committee for the conference. So Emma, would you mind telling us something about this upcoming conference? What is the theme here? What are some major events that we should not miss, and what should we expect to get?
Okay, yes, I'm so glad to be able to introduce the AASP conference. So it'll happen from July 13 to 15 on the campus of the Education University of Hong Kong, a little bit up north in Hong Kong, in the Tai Po area. And our theme this year is Asian Social Psychology in the Face of Global Challenges, Achievements, and Opportunities. When we were actually deciding on this theme, we didn't even know if we could have a face-to-face conference. That was still in fall of last year when we were deciding the actual terms. And so we wanted to focus on how the actual COVID situation actually still led to new opportunities. So we've noticed so many highly attended online conferences, for example, that never would have existed before, or the software for having these kinds of online discussions. being so accessible now, that would be one way it influences the conferences. And so giving us more opportunities to connect to each other was one of the themes we were thinking about. Of course, this theme is about social psychology research. And so we are also excited to hear about what people have been researching in the past few years. A lot of it has been influenced by the situation of having COVID-19. And mm-hmm. so we're excited to learn more about that.
Mm-hmm. I see. So talking about conferences in general now, so in your view, what are the major primary motivations for researchers, for scholars like you and me, and of course also for students to attend academic conferences? Now, obviously, it takes time, sometimes of course financial support, right, to travel to another country to attend conferences. It's not always available for everyone, right? So what are the major motivations that, you know, people attend academic conferences, and have these motivations changed over the years?
So this conference being a in-person, it's actually a hybrid conference, so people can come in person or online, seems to have been very exciting to people. So right now, we have more than 400 people who are coming in person, and mm-hmm. another more than 100, 150, almost 200 who are coming online. It seems that people are excited about coming to these conferences because it's an opportunity to meet people. And the social interactions are not necessarily ones that you know for sure will happen. You often meet people and hear about research that you simply didn't know about before. It's a wonderful opportunity to engage in serendipity and find something that you didn't know about before, get inspired by some new methodology that you didn't know about, or some new idea that you didn't know about. I think that for younger and older participants, it moves from, for younger participants, for meeting the people that they've read from, but have mm-hmm. never actually had a chance to talk to. And then maybe when we're getting up to older participants, it's also a lot about meeting your old friends, the people, or getting to know people better that you mm-hmm. had met before. So I think especially for our people who are coming for an initial time or the first time, it is really the first time. And you may meet somebody at one conference, and then hopefully 2 years later, you might meet them again, or you may have some interactions during that time and deepen your friendship or your research collaborations, bringing up new research collaborations and deepening the ones that you have. So I think that conferences are this combination of the possibility of encountering new ideas and new research that will inspire you, and also making connections with new and old friends. And there is something unique, I think, about both online and in person. And you can see that people still really want to do the in-person version. But there's also, we're very lucky because we're on the university campus that we can offer the hybrid version. It's actually very complicated, but it's wonderful also to be able to offer the online opportunities because many people simply can't make it, do all this traveling. And that also still gives you unique opportunities to connect and be exposed to new ideas. That doesn't necessarily happen or happens in a different way than it does when you're reading journals.
I see. Yeah. Well, while you were talking and sharing your views on these in response to this question, I was kind of thinking, you know, remembering the very first conference I attended that was actually in Hawaii. And I met Professor Michael Bond there. That's actually the first time. I read, of course, a lot of his work as a student, but then that's the very first time I met him in person. It was kind of unexpected because I was actually just my first time attending conferences, know nothing, just go there and let's see what happens. But then it's just an opportunity for me to meet, you know, these important figures in psychology. It's yeah. really exciting thing to do.
And I think that's actually a very, maybe a common experience that you go to conferences and you suddenly discover these people that you thought only exist on paper or only could be seen exactly. from afar, that you, when you talk to them, they're actually much more friendly than you thought they would be, or they remember you and you had no idea that they would remember you. I've had that experience a lot. And I think that is actually a common experience at conferences. And hopefully everybody should be optimistic about that and go and approach these distant heroes that you didn't ever think you would talk to.
So may I ask to you personally, so I'm quite sure you have attended a lot of conferences. So you talked about, you know, exposing yourself to ideas and making connections, meeting people in conferences. So to you personally, so how have these experiences of attending conferences help develop your career or shape your career? Or are there kind of particular events in the past experience of attending conferences that were really impressive that we kind of changed the way you approach your research or maybe approach the way you develop your career?
I think that conferences offer a different type of connection with people. I think that's actually one of the major ways that conferences can contribute in a unique way to your career, which is that you have an opportunity to more informally talk to people. That then makes it much easier later on to email somebody and ask if they are interested in a research collaboration or another meeting, or asking them for advice or to share some materials. And so it makes you feel more connected, I think, in that way, just more connected to people in your field.
Mm-hmm. I see.
I'm very excited that we can meet face-to-face again in upcoming AJSP conference. I'm very much looking forward to coming back to Hong Kong to attend the conference this summer. So I have a few questions for you with regard to conference attendance. So what are your favorite conferences? Given that there are so many conferences in the field of psychology, how do you determine which conferences to attend and what factors do you consider before you actually make the decision which conference to attend and buy the ticket to go to that conference?
I think that we often decide which conferences to go to because of kind of our academic lineage or our geographic area. When I had grad school in Canada, and so I always went to the SPSP conference, the Social Psychology Conference in the USA. Since then, I've been coming, of course, very heavily involved in the AASP and going to AASP conferences here in this area. I've also enjoyed the IACCP's conference, the International Association for Cross-Cultural Psychology. I think that each of these conferences are very unique and give different feelings. So SPSP is very focused on only a few people get to present. They're often these very exciting expert methodologies. So I go to SPSP partially to learn about research that has not been published yet, the newest trends in American social psychology. But it is also, you know, it's kind of sad that we don't get so many opportunities to hear from the great diversity of social psychology as much. Usually you can see it in the posters at SPSP. SPSP, of course, you can then also meet lots of people. I enjoy having the chance to meet especially colleagues from actually all over, quite a few from Japan, as well as across USA. AASP then has its own unique excitement. AASP is much more welcoming. We like to have lots of people presenting, and that gives you a really unique opportunity to see what kinds of research is going on in very different cultures, because AASP is also unique because it connects so many different countries that have so many different languages, so many different cultures. So AASP gives you a much better feeling for the diversity of social psychology research, especially in the Pan-Asian region. But we have economic diversity, cultural diversity, linguistic diversity that is quite unique in the associations, I think. And so I think that when we decide which conference to go to, because sometimes we have to make our choices, it's going to be partially on who you are going to meet, who you want to continue your connections with or deepen your connections with, and also the different feeling of it, what you're going to get from it.
Yeah, I also remember my first conference that I went to as a graduate student. I think that was my second year as a PhD student. I went to SPSP. That was quite overwhelming. I guess it's kind of the biggest conference in social and personality psychology. So as a very young PhD student at that time, it was really a great experience, although overwhelming, but really eye-opening to me. And then later on, I also attended smaller conferences, such as IACCP and AASP. And those conferences give me a feeling that it's more cozy because I can mingle with people who more close to my field and I can talk to them and pitch them my ideas and get the feedback. So I think the atmosphere is quite different. And I like going to bigger scale conferences as well as smaller scale so as to meet like diversity of people and also meet different purposes as well.
Yeah, and I think that like especially AASP, it is so, the leadership are really focused on helping people. They want to help social psychology develop in this pan-Asian region. So they're really going to, like, it's a very good reason to come to AASP because it's a somewhat smaller conference. You can meet those people who have more experience in social psychology research and talk with them and get good advice. And they are excited to meet you.
Yeah, more nurturing. I think, the smaller scale conferences, I feel it's more nurturing and can help with the development of my research more, particularly maybe for more junior researchers and graduate students. I do have another follow-up question for you, Emma. So given there are so many conferences, do you have any tips for us about how we can stay informed about the latest events and conferences in our field? Any maybe website we can register and also information we should get in order to stay active in these events and conferences?
I guess that the only thing that I would suggest for that is that if you can, it's good to be a member of several different organizations. So the membership fee, I think that people sometimes don't want to pay the membership fee. It seems like it's only so you can get some journals, but you could get them anyway. But actually, when you're a member of these different organizations, then you often hear more news from other members in those organizations. Mm-hmm. So being on different mailing lists gives me different insights into what are people interested in, what are they concerned about, how are they solving different kinds of problems. And they advertise many different conferences and opportunities on those listservs. So I hope that people listening here are already members of AASP, which is very cheap to join, actually. But also take a look around for other organizations and see if you can become a member of those ones, because then you will also be more likely to get exposed, again, accidentally in a way, to new and upcoming ideas and events.
And I want to add that being a member, usually you got a kind of discounted price or discounted fee for attending conferences, right? That's usually true. That's also true for AASB conference, right?
That's right. Yeah. We set it exactly our conference fees so to encourage people to become AASB members. So
yeah, is,
we hope that everybody will be a member when they come to the conference.
Yeah.
Thanks for being here today, Emma. And first of all, I want to say that I'm really looking forward to the AASB conference in Hong Kong this year and to meet everyone in person, because I think it's been quite some time since we had the last face-to-face conference. I think it was in 2019 in Taipei. I think this section also really brings back memories to me from some of the conferences that I attended as an early career scholar and brings back memories of how formative that those conferences were for me in terms of my development as an academic and all those things that we've already talked about in terms of meeting these people that have inspired us on paper in person. And in many cases, finding that they're equally inspiring as people in person. I think one of the main activities at conferences is really networking. And we often hear that we should be networking at conferences, and we heard this often as early career scholars. And I think it may be, in some cases, somewhat arbitrary for some early career scholars what it really means to be networking. My question then is what your strategy is for networking at conferences and how you ensure that you make meaningful connections with other attendees at the conference.
I hate the word networking. It sounds so instrumentalist, but of course it is a networking. I think it's actually showing interest in the people that you meet. And I think that maybe we feel shy when we go to conferences, that we sort of fear interfering or stepping in or think that somebody won't be wanting to talk to us. But if we can ask questions, introduce ourselves. You can also say something about your research and ask the person a question about it. That kind of stuff is actually a way of really showing respect and also an interest in other people that makes them very happy everybody loves to hear that somebody is interested in their work. Mm-hmm. Even if they're a fancy famous person like Michael Bond, he will be so happy to hear that you have read something of his or you have some question for him. I think maybe I've learned something new at the last conference I went to that a colleague and friend of mine asked me if I wanted to have dinner on the Friday night. And she said she had already booked a table at a nearby restaurant and she was finding people to go. And I had never actually thought of that strategy before. I think that's an excellent strategy. And she also asked people to come. And I, even before she asked, I suddenly realized that I had not asked that person because I assumed that person was too famous and busy and that she wouldn't want to come to our dinner. But actually, she happened to be free that night and she was very happy to come to our dinner. So my colleague who was doing this, she said, you know, I've just learned you just ask. No harm in asking, just ask. And so maybe for graduate students, that's a little more difficult to ask a professor to have dinner with you. But for you, for them, I also would suggest definitely see if your advisor can invite you along for dinner with other people. That was a formative experience for me as a graduate student, is my advisor meeting up with his friends and bringing me along and then getting to talk about ideas with them. That was very fun. So if you have that, that is very lucky. Or also just getting to know other people who are your age or stage of career, because those will be your future colleagues as well. And you can have that same attitude, just ask. There's no harm in asking. It can be really nice, actually. Most people really appreciate being asked to come to dinner or have coffee or eat lunch or simply to stay behind a talk and ask more questions. In the online version also, that is, I think, so important that at the end of a talk that you show yourself on screen and you ask questions. It can actually be very intimate on Zoom. You are there with the professors and just a few other people, it seems, on the screen. It can be a really nice chance to sort of hear the conversations that other people are having, which you're allowed to listen in on because it's, they know you are there, and it's much less awkward than it would be perhaps at a conference. So online conferences also offer these unique opportunities to talk about ideas and show interest. And I think that's what networking is showing interest in other people and being welcoming yourself, actually, instead of waiting for somebody to welcome you.
I can relate to all those things that you are saying. And I think all those things are true. You have to show an interest as well. But I also think that, and you definitely have to be reasonably forward, perhaps not too forward. I mean, there's nothing wrong with being too forward either, but I think some connections just happen naturally. The nice thing about conferences is being in a place. So I think my first conference actually was in Wellington, but perhaps not thinking of Wellington, thinking of Kota Kinabalu, for example, when we were there for ASP. And then you meet people from all four corners of the world. And then you realize that many of them are reading the same papers, are thinking about the same thing, same things, have the same kind of priorities, and, you know, come from similar places, have similar backgrounds, get into social cultural psychology for the same reasons. And I think that's a quite magical thing. I think there is something about that community that I think is really important. And depending on which department you're in, typically social and cultural psychology, of course, it may be the case in some institutions that that's the biggest research group, but in many cases, it's not the biggest research group. So it's really nice to be able to connect with similar research groups from around the world and researchers and developing your, you know, philosophy that you're part of something bigger. And I think that's, I find that to be a quite magical feeling and refining how you're thinking about things by taking inspiration from how social psychology, cultural psychology, cross-cultural psychology is thought about and conducted in different parts of the world. The formativeness of the experiences, the refinement of how you think of things, that actually there are other people out there who have legitimacy within the research community, who think in similar ways as you do, and therefore it gives you some validation for how you're thinking about things and gives you a greater courage to pursue that way of doing things and that way of being within academia. And I find the ASP, like I take a lot from the ASP. That's why I continue. I think I've been to ASP since 2005. So that was my first conference, and I still love attending them because they do give me something very, very special that I don't think that I necessarily get from some of the bigger conferences that I attend.
I should also mention the AASP Summer School, which is for graduate students. And I think that that is can be a very formative experience for graduate students and give you more time to make those unique and happy connections with other people that are actually a major part of conferences. You know, more than just the things you're going to learn from the conference, it really is the chance to meet people and bond with people and talk and make friends.
I did attend the summer schools. I do highly recommend that to early career scholars. And that was definitely formative. And it was just having, I don't remember how many days exactly, but it was a good few days, I think 3 to 5 or something like that. And just being surrounded by really smart people, really smart mentors who are really kind of have your best interests in mind. And I grew a lot from that, actually. That was definitely a very formative experience. So yeah, summer schools, I tell my PhD students the same. When there's an opportunity to attend a summer school, just attend to do it. Mm-hmm. Just do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good.
I want to pick up one thing that Emma earlier mentioned. You know, when you attend conferences, you want to meet people, obviously, and show interest in their work and then build the connections. And that's for earlier career researchers or students that the connection is not just about to someone who are more senior experienced or authority figures in the field. It's also very important, as Mensah just mentioned, is people who are of your same age, right? People who are at the same stage as yours, right? Your peers. I remember it was two or four or five in Texas. Actually, that's where I met Angela in the US in a conference, SPSP conference maybe, with Professor Qiyu Chiu's and Yingyi Hong's lab. We have actually a group of students of the same age, and Angela and others, Levi Kwan, etc. They were studying in the U.S. Right? I was studying in Hong Kong, so we didn't geographically or too far. We share the same cultural background. We're from Hong Kong or similar regions, and then the conference becomes an opportunity for us to get to know each other and then find out more about. Okay, we actually have people from the same region, although we are studying different parts of the world now, but actually we share similar interests. And then these relationships actually become a long-term relationship where we are not only collaborators, we are good friends to each other, you know, till today. Let's talk about something a little bit bigger, maybe, kind of as biggest challenges humanity is facing, right? We know what happened in the past several years with the pandemic. And of course, another challenge we are facing now is climate change. I was just curious how these things have impacted the way, you know, conferences are organized or the way we conduct conferences. Emma earlier mentioned something about hybrid mode, right? The upcoming conference, AASP conference, will be in a hybrid mode, right? That means we have an online mode. Looking forward, so maybe 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road. So what do you think about, you know, the way conferences are organized? How is it going to change? Pandemic is one of the reasons I asked this question, but another thing I mentioned earlier is climate change. And I don't know if you know about this, but some academics at least are talking about reducing conference travels or even any work-related travel in order to reduce emissions. I personally kind of trying to minimize travel for conferences. In order to reduce my personal contributions to climate change, my personal emissions. That's something also happening because of the problem of climate change. So these kind of crises, I think, may have some impacts on the way we organize conferences. So Emma, in your view, of course, based on also experience with AASP conference, so what do you think? What's going to happen next in the near future, maybe in a little bit longer, midterm, longer future? How are conferences, academic conferences, going to change? And to what extent we know who wants to attend conferences may need to kind of adjust the way we approach academic conferences.
We did have a little struggle when we were even deciding, should we just have an online conference? More accessible to everybody, you know, it has some simplicity in some ways. I think that the fact that hybrid is or Zoom meetings are available does change a bit our motivations for going for conferences. For example, that I now find it very difficult to motivate myself to go to SPSP in USA because there are so many other opportunities to meet people on Zoom. And, you know, flying across the world, 20-hour trip, the time change, there's lots of inconveniences as well for that, for the conference travel. So you need to have good reasons to do it. And it would be ideal if you don't have to do it quite as often as you did before, if there are hybrid options available. And I guess that more and more that conferences will want to have some aspect in a hybrid mode or online mode, because we've now learned it is a completely valid way of connecting with other people. It's different from in person. I think that there's, it's just different. There's, anyway, I'm sure you guys can think of many ways how it just feels different. But online Zoom meetings also have their unique positives. For example, it makes it hugely easier to organize things. I can meet with my organizing committee who are in different countries. We can meet every 2 weeks on Zoom. We can communicate and collaborate in that way. And then in the conference, also, it feels very selfish to have only in-person version, because there are many reasons that people can't come to an in-person version. In addition to the cost, there's maybe caretaking require people you're taking care of, et cetera. It's difficult to travel. And so I guess that there will be more and more pressure on conferences to try to have some aspects online or more accessible after the conferences, like videos. But we also really need more help to develop that kind of stuff. I know that when we're thinking about doing that for our conference, this is the thing that keeps me up at night, because I'm imagining we have to have every single of our classrooms here has to have a Zoom room. And there needs to be somebody who is paying attention to the Zoom room, who is muting those people who accidentally turn on their microphone, who is making sure that somebody who's asking a question can actually be heard, you know, both the people in the classroom physically and also the people on Zoom. And it's going to be quite a dance coordinating both the online and in-person aspects and allowing people to really interact with each other, which is what we want it to be like. And it requires essentially lots of support, maybe money. We're going to be hopefully doing it mostly with volunteers, with senior graduate students or undergrads who are excited about psychology and who will be able to coordinate this. But that's a lot of people in different, you know, monitoring lots of Zoom rooms. We have on a university campus, so we actually have Zoom links. We can automatically record the events. We can automatically upload it to a server where it's going to be password protected, et cetera. But those are the kinds of things that definitely not every place has. And we're just lucky, for example, that our Hong Kong Education University of Hong Kong had so much experience with hybrid teaching that we have all these things set up and already ready to use. But will other conferences be able to do that? Is that it can be actually quite expensive to do that in a non-academic setting. But I think that will be interesting if conference venues in general start to think that this is a necessary part of conferences to allow people to join in online as well as in person.
Thanks a lot for the answer, for sharing in terms of your views about, you know, the future of academic conferences. And of course, we feel grateful to you, not only for joining the discussion today, I think for taking up this very important role of organizing, chairing the organizing committee for the conference. That's obviously a lot of work, but also very important. And I look forward to attending the upcoming AASP conference. And also, it's also an opportunity for me to meet many of you. Emma will be seeing you here, there. Sammy and Angela will also be there, I'm sure. And many of our audience readers, I'm quite sure, will be there too. So it's a good opportunity for us to see each other.
It's a great opportunity for us too. We're so happy that we can give this opportunity, like throwing a party for everybody to come online or in person. It's really actually very happy for us that we can produce this setting where serendipity can happen. And we look forward to seeing what people get out of the conference. I hope a lot.
Right. So to our audience and readers, if you're planning to attend, so do talk to us, right? As Emma just mentioned, no harm asking, If you want to talk to anyone, including one of us, just feel free to initiate a conversation. We'll be there. We'll see you there. Once again, thank you, Emma, for joining us. Very happy to have this wonderful conversation with you.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope to see you in July.
That ends our special topic discussion and also our episode today. Please stay tuned. See you in the next episode. Bye-bye.